Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Fuel the Pedal, that podcast usually on all things nutrition for cycling and endurance sports with a twist. Today is one of those twist days. We are at episode 26, Viral Misinformation and Pseudoscience, Beyond COVID-19, with none other than Anthony Warner, aka The Angry Chef. I'm Gabriel Martins, and you're listening to Fuel the Pedal podcast. Welcome back to Fuel the Pedal. Thank you so much for being on that side. As usual, I am your host, Gabriel Martins, that Portuguese nutritionist broadcasting from Madrid in a clumsy English, but doing my best to reach all of you. I hope you're all doing well and staying safe at your homes. So first of all, there's a bird in the tree right outside the window that you're probably able to hear, so I'm afraid he's going to keep us company for a while. Let's bear with him. Judging by the title, you might have guessed that today's episode is a bit different than usual, and it's related to the current situation regarding the COVID-19 and how viral misinformation affected us during this phase. Today is episode 26, and I know it's a very long episode, and that will be my fault. I just have so many questions, and I've been wanting to talk with today's guest for a long time now. But if you're into this kind of topics as much as I am, I can promise you that it's worth your time. The reason for doing this episode is also the same reason for trying to keep this podcast alive. The excess of unfiltered and false information leading to misinformed people that is not only typical in the world of nutrition, that gives a voice to people with no credentials thanks to the internet, is going out of control, and it would be somehow predictable to get to false information circulating regarding the current coronavirus pandemic. This will be one to listen in parts, if you will, while doing your chores around the house. And to talk about this topic today, we have with us none other than The Angry Chef. His name is Anthony Warner, and Anthony is a professional chef with a background in biochemistry who got increasingly irate at claims linking food and health made by people with no qualifications. This irritation led him creating The Angry Chef blog, an alter ego that gets riled up about things from fad diets and detoxing to superfoods and veganism. Anthony is the author of The Truth About Fat and The Hungry Chef, a Guardian Best Food Book of the Year and winner in the Health and Lifestyle category and the inaugural Hearst Big Book Awards. He writes regularly for publications including New Scientist, Men's Health, The Sunday Times, and The Daily Telegraph. Anthony will be sharing his forthright views regarding the current coronavirus pandemic and how some opportunistic influencers try to take advantage of the situation to sell their immunity shots, and will inevitably tackle some nutrition-related topics as well as discuss some possible ways to help us filter information and be critical about the information that we're exposed to. Let's not waste any more time and get on with this viral misinformation and pseudoscience beyond COVID-19 with The Hungry Chef up next on Fuel the Pedal podcast. Anthony, it's so good to have you here with us. Thank you for taking the time to be here in these troubled times. How are you holding up?
Personally, I'm doing pretty well. You know, I've obviously been at home for quite a while, and you do go a bit stir crazy, but you know, I have to count my blessings at the moment. I think I'm in a fortunate position and situation, and actually this part of the country which I'm in right now has not been affected too badly, but I'm acutely aware that many other people are having a really tough time at the moment.
No doubt. Most of us should be counting our blessings, but these are definitely sensitive times for everyone. So, Anthony, for the listeners who are unaware of who you are, can you tell us a bit about you and especially about who exactly is The Angry Chef?
Yeah, certainly. My name is Anthony Warner. I'm a chef and a food and science writer, I think is probably the best way of describing me. I work for the food industry. I'm in work in product development, and I also write a blog called The Angry Chef, where I talk about food science and nutrition science and kind of made my reputation exposing fad diets and pseudoscience in the world of food, which I think is an interesting area. And I've written a few books now. I've written three books now, two which have been published so far. One one's going to be coming out later this year, and write for UK newspapers on this sort of area, and for New Scientist and various other magazines. I'm not a scientist, but I do have a background in I have a degree in biochemistry, and I work in the food industry. I work with a lot of nutrition scientists and dietitians.
Terrific. So first of all, Anthony, it is for me a tremendous pleasure to be able to finally talk with you. We have just so many things to get into regarding the coronavirus situation. We have to talk about nutrition in general as well, pseudoscience, and wrap up by having us try to get with ways to help us all filter information, and above all, being critical and knowing who to listen, whose opinion to consider, and knowing who not to listen and just ignore. I think this is probably the foundation of today's talk with you, and it's, I think, what you try to transmit in your blog and in your books as well. So apart from all the coronavirus situation, where the self-proclaimed experts take the opportunity to claim what supplements you should be taking to boost your immune system, ignoring what a truly boosted immune system really is, which is really not a good idea to have all the time. So these are the same type of experts that blindly defend certain types of diets and that have invaded our lives through social media. I'm talking about paleo, functional foods, keto dieting, and plant-based, which is debatable, I know, but as a nutritionist, I prefer to think that I'm on the flexible side of things, and I believe that many of these diets may have their possible role in a specific moment and context, much like utensils that you can use in the kitchen, for example. But I digress. My point is that social media gave a voice to these experts, and all of them have some things in common, I think. First, they all believe that reading a study on PubMed makes them scientists. And second, and in my opinion, perhaps the most serious, is that they blindly believe that their way of eating is the only way possible. And it's not unusual to see typical rampages and defensive postures on social media around these nutrition-related topics. So this, as expected, created some ramifications to the current situation regarding the coronavirus, with articles and posts on social media, you name it, about supplements and immune boosting shots taking advantage of the situation to sell snake oil, which I believe is disgusting beyond belief. This is where you come in, Anthony. Now, I've been following your work for a while, and it's funny because I knew of your work because of the first speaker here on the podcast, Dr. Javier Gonzalez from the University of Bath, and he posted a tweet about your book, The Angry Chef, The Bad Science and the Truth About Healthy Eating. 2 days after, I bought the book, devoured it, and loved it, and since then, Anthony released his anger again in his blog, where he often writes about food-related topics and pseudoscience, but this last one, called Going Viral, regarding the current coronavirus situation and the immune boosting claims around the web, really was a masterpiece that I strongly recommend you to read. And so I had to at least try and bring Anthony here to put to use some of his anger on the podcast. In a time that, just as you said, we should be counting our blessings and especially thanking the stars, I think, to our farmers, drivers, logisticians, managers, cleaners, factory workers, even shop floor staff who are breaking themselves so that we can fill our cupboards. So, Anthony, that was a big intro. Let's start with the most obvious question and the one that I'm sure you've been asked before. Why are you so angry, and what sort of led you to start writing about these topics in the first place?
I would apologize in advance to anyone listening expecting me to be screaming into the microphone right now. I have to admit, I do write a character, I write in character. And the character is all about getting angry about the sort of pseudoscience in food and diets and all this sort of misinformation being spread around about science and generally. And it's quite a useful writing device to have this sort of very profane and angry sort of character who writes and speaks in a certain way. But that doesn't mean I'm not actually, these things don't get to me. And especially at the moment, it's just been really awful to behold. Because, I'm a chef. At the heart of what I do is loving food. I really love food. I think it's a very important thing. I think it's our relationship with food is a very important relationship in our life, and we should, you know, value it, and we should get to a point where we find pleasure in food. And I get very, very angry at people making others feel guilty about how they eat and guilty about how they live, because, you know, it's there's no place for those sort of things in food. And so that's kind of where at the heart of it is really stripping away all this guilt and this shame and this difficult relationship we have with food, and getting back to a point where food is a joy and a pleasure and something that we should be thankful for, rather than just feeling terrible about most of the time, which is what we are encouraged to do a lot of the time. So I mean, and that's really the heart of why I started writing this blog and why I started getting angry. And when I started writing it, I exposed more and more stuff that I found about people misrepresenting the science around food, misrepresenting nutrition science, and just misrepresenting the truth in often quite a pernicious way, often quite a dangerous way. You know, and you had this rejection of expertise, which is a global thing, which has happened in so many spheres. But, you know, my sphere is food, nutrition and diet. And this rejection of expertise, which I think is one of the most dangerous things to happen to society over the past five years or so. And what we suddenly see now is that playing out in the most horrific fashion, because we're now at this point where we have a serious health crisis. For people to be making these sort of false claims about immune boosting foods and superfoods and special diets that are going to give you extraordinary health, for people to be making those claims, basically selling stuff to rich people to make them feel guilty, then that, it was kind of funny, and it was kind of sort of quirky and cute, and Gwyneth Paltrow was out sort of doing all these things on her website where she has the medical medium who speaks to a ghost from the future and gives advice about eating different things to cure different diseases, and it's quirky and it's funny. But then you have this health crisis, and everything that people like me and lots of other people as well have been shouting about for years suddenly is coming home to roost, and we're saying, actually, you know, selling stuff to the world, well, then all right, fair enough, you know, that's annoying and it's frustrating, but you can cope with that. But the very same people, or many of the very same people, are now, you know, this undermining of expertise is undermining the medical expertise that we need to be listening to. And it's, you know, it's really quite a dangerous situation we've got ourselves into, that we've reached this point where we have such rejection of the science, which gives us an amazing life and keeps us safe and keeps us well and keeps us well fed. We've become so detached from that reality, and this is kind of something, this disease now is something that's bringing us back to reality and saying, oh, actually, we need to listen to experts, because there's many, many reasons why this has happened, and all of them are coming together now in this crisis. If we don't get back to having a better understanding, better sort of scientific literacy within communities, then we're going to end up in serious trouble.
Well, that actually sums it up quite well. One could almost say that this undermining of expertise is the foundation for all the market that has been created to sell not only this immune boosting supplements, but for many other businesses in the healthy food industry, if you will. So reject all that medicine has brought us so far. Natural remedies will cure you is the message. And it keeps the market engine going, right?
Certainly. You know, I mean, that's why it's been so persistent, because a lot of people have monetized it. You know, a lot of people have an interest in rejecting expertise and because that gives them the ability to sell their particular diet or their particular fad or their particular supplement or whatever it is. Because even though all the conventional medical advice is saying, no, that's a useless thing to sell, that's valueless, they can reject that expertise and they can sell the thing that they want to sell. And, you know, so when a lot of people have a financial interest in it happening, it's going to perpetuate. And then we have, I mean, what fascinates me is how our modern way of processing information and accessing information is often through social media and through various different sort of networks that we tap into. And the way we interact with information has dramatically changed in the past 20 years, beyond all recognition. When I was at university, which was admittedly quite a long time ago now, if I wanted to look up a scientific paper, I had to go to a library and sort of access an academic library and find the paper. But now if I type a couple of words into my computer, I have access to hundreds of scientific papers. The way we access information has dramatically changed. The way we are taught is dramatically changed. When I was studying, you basically went into a classroom and the guy at the front of the classroom had lots of knowledge and you didn't have much knowledge at all, and this guy gave you some knowledge. But now all of us have access to far more information than the person at the front of the room does, but on our phones or in our pockets. So we have the information, and what the person at the front of the room should be doing is telling us how to interpret and understand that information and how to make sense of it and how to apply that within the world. And I think people are rapidly these days are mistaking information with knowledge. They're thinking that because they've found some information that they know something, whereas actually they often don't really understand that information. It's all about interpreting. So, and I think perhaps the way we teach science, certainly in schools, has kind of been a cause of this problem, because in a school, for instance, you're taught that science is a list of facts, a list of information that's all true, whereas the actual reality of of science is obviously quite different to that. And most people still seem to think that there's a load of scientific facts and it's all in the peer-reviewed literature. So if you find something in that literature, which you can all have access to and you can all search these days, then it's definitely true and it's definitely a fact. Whereas the reality is it's often very different, and science is about exploring and it's about sort of finding a path towards the truth, as I'm sure most of your listeners are acutely aware of, but a lot of people aren't, and you end up with these sort of social media silos of people who have some really sort of strange beliefs, and these beliefs can sort of propagate and they can often slip into the mainstream. And it's up to people like me and lots of other people as well to sort of debunk and pull apart those ideas and to shout about this problem we have with information and with knowledge in our society at the moment. And, hopefully what we're going through now will actually sort of galvanize that and make people realize what the importance of it is.
Yes, for sure. And it's also funny, because what I often try to do here in the podcast is to try and bring people to talk about their specific field of expertise in research or in cycling or any other area. And the speakers up so far, from what I noticed, had one thing in common. They are never 100% sure about all the questions, because they know of the limitations of their own research, and that's the essence of science. You can only apply things to a specific context. But on the other hand, the pattern you see on these self-proclaimed experts is that they are always sure about and they know everything, which is what people want to hear, the oversimplifications and certainty, which is a curious contrast. So some of the listeners might not see things this way, but the perception that I have as a nutritionist is that we got used to exaggerate the power of foods and the power of nutrition, jumping from trend to trend, categorizing particular foods as superfood, and now all of a sudden the intestine is suddenly the most popular organ in the body because your gut microbiota is the key to cure everything, which I'm sorry, but we just don't know that yet. And we are so focused on being the first and more worried than being right than being correct. I don't know if you have this perception as well, Anthony, but one particular phrase that annoys me is that let the food be your medicine, which I believe it's nonsense and only feeds this idea of exaggerating nutrition to create a template to sell books. And I'm sorry, Anthony, but I get too overwhelmed with this topic. So with all this in mind, Anthony, my question for you would be, from the perspective of who creates this fake sensationalistic information regarding nutrition, what motivates these self-proclaimed experts to do this? Do you think that they actually believe in what they sell? And from the perspective of who consumes this information, why do we seem to have lost this ability to think for ourselves and effectively filter this information?
Yeah, no, they're a really good question. I tear myself apart about this idea of do the people selling this stuff believe it? You know, when I, because, you know, in my book, certainly I've looked at the real dark heart of this sort of pseudoscience about people claiming their diets can cure cancer, about people claiming their diets can reverse, you know, can cure autism. You know, not that autism is something that can be or should be cured. You know, and various other, you know, people who prey on various other extremely ill people, and, you know, and we're very much seeing that now. You know, my inboxes are full of people saying they can fight immunity and their diets can you know, fight coronavirus. You know, it's, and I work, you know, do these people selling this stuff believe that they can help? I really hope they do in some ways, because the alternative that they don't believe it and they're still trying to sell it to us, I think is too terrible to contemplate. I think that's an awful idea that they would be that exploitative and they would be that manipulative. So I really hope that most of them do believe these things and are just victims of, you know, a lack of proper education and a lack of understanding and an overconfidence in their own ability. You know, we have this, you know, this world now where confidence in your ability and confidence in your knowledge seems to be more important than actual knowledge. You know, you seem to be rewarded for just being overconfident, which is obviously a ridiculous thing. There's something you said earlier, which there's a quote from, who was it from? I think it's George Bernard Shaw, who said, you know, fools and fanatics are always so certain of themselves and wiser men are full of doubt. And that's the thing. You know, the more intelligence people have, the more they know about a subject, the more uncertain they are about it, especially nutrition. Nutrition is almost by design an incredibly uncertain science. It's very difficult to do really, really hard science in nutrition. You know, and that might, you know, I know there is good science in nutrition, but in terms of the effects of diet on long-term health conditions, it's very difficult to do really good experiments. You know, it's very difficult to do a randomized controlled trial of diet. How do you actually do that? You know, so, you know, much of the evidence is based on epidemiological studies, which everyone will know have a huge amount of problems with them. A lot of it, you know, always based on animal studies, which, you know, we're not mice, we're not rats or whatever, you know, so people will dismiss them. When people say we should have more randomized controlled trials, I'm not even sure 100%. A lot of the time, I'm not sure what they mean by saying we should have more randomized controlled trials in nutrition science. You know, if you're looking at the long-term effects of a dietary pattern on someone's health over 20 years, how are you doing a randomized controlled trial? I'm not sure. I know there are things that can be done, but, you know, what you get is a science which has an enormous amount of uncertainty. And that's a real problem for us. That's a real problem for our brains, because our brains don't like uncertainty. We are drawn to certainty. We're drawn to people who have certain answers. So if you are someone who really understands nutrition and has a lifetime of knowledge and is a researcher or a dietitian or a clinician or someone with an enormous amount of experience, and you ask them for a certain answer about, you know, what diet they should have or whatever, they won't give you an answer. They won't give you a certain answer. They'll give you nuance and uncertainty, and they'll reflect the true state of knowledge and the true state of the science. You know, that's not very, that doesn't sit very well with our minds. People like certainty. And then, so people selling these diets will look towards, they'll sort of develop certain answers in their mind in order to kind of, you know, make themselves feel more in control, because when something is out of control and uncertain, that scares us, and so we grasp for something, we grasp for, you know, some sort of certainty. And so often people will, you know, if someone's coming along saying sugar is the root of all evil, or gluten is toxic, or, you know, don't eat nightshade vegetables, or don't eat meat, or don't eat dairy, or something like that, I'm giving you some really, really hard and fast rules, even though those rules are not based on good evidence if you're looking for long-term health. Unfortunately, they are very, very compelling. Those arguments are very compelling for most people, especially people who don't, you know, aren't really, really into nutrition science and aren't really that interested in food. People are just out there looking for a few little shortcuts to help them live a bit better life and feel a bit healthier. Those things are really, really compelling, and they draw people in. And it's that desire for certainty that our brains have. We are pattern forming animals. We are storytelling creatures. We like a certain outcome, and when the actual science doesn't give you that certain outcome, we get drawn to this sort of uncertainty, and that can be extremely compelling for people. I think that can make people believe their own stuff. You know, it can make people believe their own dietary ideologies, but it also draws people in, and lots of people can then monetize that. And perhaps they think they're helping. Perhaps they think they're giving people, giving people something good. Perhaps they think they're helping people out by giving them advice about which foods they've read are immune boosting and which bit of science they've misinterpreted to think that that's going to help you stop getting a viral infection if you eat a certain fruit or something. Perhaps they think they're helping people, but they're sort of victims of their inability to understand their own ignorance a lot of the time. I believe and I hope. I think there are some charlatans out there. There are some people who are absolute snakes and are fleecing people for money. But I think most people are just, have this unwarranted confidence in their own knowledge and their own ability and their own understanding.
I surely remember that one of stop eating nightshade vegetables. It was part of the paleo diet and now it's gone. But I'll stick to what you said about the limitations of nutrition information. I don't consider myself a researcher, although our group has been producing some research in the past few years. And the thing is, research in whatever field it is, each study is a small piece of a puzzle that when there's been enough years to get all those pieces together, if they fit, you can start to see what's the picture behind it. And from the perspective I have, what I see is that people who read an abstract on PubMed or share a random new study on Twitter, they think that by having one small piece of the puzzle, that they know what the full picture looks like. And it takes years of cumulative research to get those bits together to come up with something, which could indicate that people are not perhaps ready to deal with information, at least this kind of information. This is a sensitive topic and a tricky question to answer, Anthony, but do you believe that health-related information should be somehow filtered or regulated? We know, for example, that Facebook newsfeed has started downranking misleading health info and dangerous cures. Do you believe that other social media platforms or web pages would require this as well? Or is there a way in the long term to teach people how to do this for themselves?
Yeah, it's a question I get asked a lot about should it be regulated. I work in the food industry, as I said, I only work in certain parts of the food industry. I don't work in the sort of health food type parts, and would never associate myself with anything making sort of claims. But what we do in the food industry is incredibly highly regulated in terms of what you can and can't say about a food product, and if you want to advertise that food product, what you can and can't say is incredibly heavily and completely rightly regulated. So you can't say it boosts your immune function. You can't say anything that without passing through extremely strict legislation on health claims, and that's the European legislation. Then in the UK we have legislation on advertising, and if you're making a false claim, that's potentially a criminal offence. So the question is, should that regulation then be extended to blogs or recipe books or magazines or the press or TV nutritionists talking about food and diet? I mean, I probably think it should be. I do think that there is perhaps a place for that, but it would be so hard to regulate, even within the food manufacturing industry. Certainly in small stores and online, you can buy stuff which makes some absolutely outrageous health claims, which are completely against the European regulations on food and health claims. Even that's hard to regulate. If you extend that to every single blog and every single recipe website and every single recipe book, I think that it would be extremely difficult to enforce, and so perhaps it's not even worth regulating unless you're going to invest an enormous amount of time in regulating the whole of social media. And the more it gets sort of the more you clamp down on it, the more you'll just pop up somewhere else, and that's just how these things work, and it'd be incredibly difficult to do. I think there might be a fair amount of self-regulation will start to happen, especially after what's happened here. Also, if you go back to, I don't know if you're aware of the case of Belle Gibson in Australia, who was someone who claimed to have a brain tumor and claimed she was treating it with diet and health, managing her health with various dietary, quite extreme dietary interventions. It turned out, you know, she was you know, claiming this fraudulently, and you know, was exposed and fined, and the publisher who was going to publish her book, it ended up having to pulp the whole thing, and there was threats of legal action and all sorts of things. So, you know, there might be cases like that might cause some sort of self-regulation. I doubt if it'll really, you know, massively change. But what I think you have to change, and I think I've said this already, is you have to improve the way we assimilate and think about information. You know, you have to improve basic science education so people understand that there is uncertainty at the heart of science, and understand that, you know, when somebody is very, very certain about a thing and all the experts sort of say something different, that person is probably wrong, however compelling they sound and however much anecdote they have and however many, you know, people endorse them, however many celebrities endorse them. You know, that person is probably still wrong. We need to encourage more critical thinking, and we need to take science education back from this list of facts to this, the very first time you teach science should be about critical thinking and understanding what good quality evidence looks like, you know, because nutrition is the science which most people, intersect with. You know, most people who are not interested in science, they intersect with nutrition science perhaps more than any other area of science, because it does affect them, because we all have to eat and people are interested in health. You know, so it's essential that people develop those critical thinking skills, because, like I said, you can regulate it. It will be incredibly hard. I think it should be, and in an ideal world it would be, but what you have to have is more people out there who are good at critical thinking, who understand the evidence and are more willing to challenge these people, because who are making these sort of claims. And I hope that will happen. I hope that things like this sort of health crisis, where we realize how fragile our health is and we realize how, you know, dependent upon experts and expertise we are, you know, all these people who are new gurus of health, they only can exist in a system where all these sort of terrible infectious diseases that science has managed to get on top of to such a large extent. And like you said, when one of these comes along that we don't really have any way of dealing with yet, we realize how far our progress has been, you know, how far and how fast we've come in such a short time. And, you know, so these people saying they're the new gurus of health, they don't have any answers for sort of serious health problems. They're selling stuff. The only reason they can sell that stuff is because of the progress that has been made in science and medicine over the years. Regulation, I don't think is a nice dream, but I don't think it's going to happen. It's critical thinking that we really need.
Sure, and let's hope that by the end of this episode we were able to contribute with our tiny grain of sand. And Anthony, we could almost establish a parallel here with many of the things in your first book, The Bad Science and the Truth About Healthy Eating, where you go around the diets that were trending back then, 2016, 17, yeah, which interestingly are not the same diets trending right now. But from all those, I believe one is still deeply rooted in this moment, and it's the clean eating movement, and the belief that natural is always best for us. Now, you mentioned something funny in your article going viral that I mentioned, which was, and I quote, "The virus and the disease that it causes are as natural as the sunset. The tools that save us will be forged at the cutting edge of science. Genetically modified plants will produce viral antibodies to help create vaccines. The latest gene editing techniques, so demonized and fought against in our food systems, will edge us closer to solutions. We will happily inject things deemed unsafe by supposed environmental campaigners, and it will be right for us to do so. It is technology that gives us hope." Anthony, this question was actually sent by my good colleague Helena Trigueiro from Portugal, who is really into these topics as well. Why do you believe that it is so difficult for people to understand that this sustainability we all desperately seek requires something that is viable in the long term, and not all natural things are good, such as this virus, and that things like GMO-free and organic farming for the moment have no evidence that can feed us all in the long term.
It's a big problem. I think what you really need to understand about a lot of this stuff is that based on basic, very human misunderstandings of the world, and things that we are all in some way susceptible. One I mentioned before was about us seeking simplicity and not liking complexity. That's a very human thing. Another really important one is that we do have this tendency, sort of natural, seemingly innate sort of tendency for all humans, perhaps, that we tend to idolize the past to some extent. We look back to a point in the past which we think it was the ideal time. Psychologists have described it to me as being perhaps because when we look at the past, we look back and as our bodies age and decline, we look back at the past and we kind of falsely equate our own decline with the decline of society or the world in general. And so we think that now is terrible and we think the past is good, generally speaking. Actually, it's a very, very human tendency. We kind of all do it. It's almost instinctive. You see it in politics, make America great again, take my country back. A lot of political rhetoric is about going back to a time in the past. So that's something that's very appealing. But actually, when you analyze it, you think, where are we going back to? What period was really great? I'm not really sure. And it's also at the heart of almost every single major religion is this idea that, there's a lost Eden or whatever the equivalent is in different religions, that we have humanity has ruined and we should be trying to get back to that state. And, things were perfect and humanity ruined it somehow. So this idea that the past is a better place is very ingrained into us. It's almost by every single measure not true. If you look at the food system, people say you should eat like your great grandmother used to, but if you actually analyze what your great grandmother ate, certainly in this country, my great grandmother probably had a pretty terrible diet. She probably had 90% odd of her calories came from bread. There was no cold supply chain. There was very little dairy. There was very little fresh produce. Most of it was extremely seasonal. There'd be long periods of a year where there'd be very little at all. They probably had a pretty terrible diet. And, also most people were in that time were desperately poor and, had, really, really struggled to live. And medicine was pretty terrible in that time. And far more people suffered awful diseases, things like polio. Not too long ago, you go back to diseases like smallpox, which are just horrendous diseases, which medicine has conquered. So by almost every single measure, right now, although we're going through a pretty terrible time, this moment right now is one of the best times to be alive as a human. Even though we are going through a global pandemic now and there's enormous suffering, we also have more tools to fight it than we've ever had in history. We're perhaps not always using them in exactly the right way, but we will get through this in a way that the other generations would not have got through. And this idea of idolizing the past is very ingrained. So it ends up being with this sort of naturalistic fallacy that people look back at the past and say things were natural back then, but they're not natural now because they're man-made and different. And it's really curious, how when our lives, the further our lives take us away from nature, and most of us in European countries would have lives which are pretty separate from nature. But the further away we get from nature, the more we idolize it. And it's, people say things are natural, then they must be good for you. That's clearly not true. It's almost a delusional thing to say because there are so many things in nature that really want to kill you and really want to do you harm. So many of the most deadly poisons of all are completely natural. Botulism, botulism toxin is completely natural. But a teaspoon of it will kill 20,000 people. So much of nature wants to kill you. So many animals want to hurt you. So many viruses and bacteria want to do you harm. And so many man-made things are remarkably good for you. So it is a natural. There is this naturalistic fallacy. It's something that it's a shortcut that people use. And shortcuts are always dangerous. You always need to look out for them because they're almost always oversimplifying a complex reality. Certainly, there are man-made things which are dangerous, and there's lots about humanity which is not great. You really need to be careful idolizing things and breaking things into particular categories, because as you said, so much of our food system and the food, the vegetables and the fruits we eat and the animals we eat and the, we raise for livestock, they're, you know, are they natural? I mean, they're not entirely. They don't, you know, they're not similar to anything that exists in nature. The idea that we could eat a diet anything like our Paleolithic ancestors, which the paleo diet people think we can, is absolutely fanciful. It's absolutely ridiculous. And it's just based on an arbitrary set of rules. You know, it's just basically a quite a restricted diet which people lose weight on, but with some sort of caveman fantasies attached to it, you know, more to do with episodes of the Flintstones than it is to do with any sort of real study of the diets of ancient humans. But, you know, it's just, again, it's people looking for shortcuts, looking for ways to navigate a complex world and a complex and uncertain world, and there's scary stuff around, so they look for simple shortcuts, and they often look, you know, because these things aren't simple, they're almost always looking in the wrong place.
Oversimplification and shortcutting, no doubt, are the main keywords to retain about this problematic. Anthony, we've tackled a similar topic here on the podcast some time ago on episode 9, where we had James Kennedy talking about chemophobia and the fear of everything that is chemical in our lives. And one of the main quotes that really stuck with me was that, health-wise, we are really good at identifying risks, but terrible at quantifying them. Would you agree with this statement, not only regarding disease risk, but also in this exaggeration of the effects that certain food components and supplements may have on our health? How do you believe that this is affecting us?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the perception of risk, I think, is something that is fascinating, because we do, I think, when it's explained to people properly, it's people do get it. You know, people, the sensible people, will see this pandemic we're going through and understand that, you know, this is a serious thing, and we need to take this incredibly seriously. Even if, you know, the actual risk to me as an individual is low, you know, this is an unbelievably serious thing. So, and that's quite a complex, nuanced thing that we're trying to get across to people, and people do get it. But I think risk is incredibly poorly communicated very, very often. And I spend a lot of my time attacking Instagram diet gurus and people claiming remarkable weight loss, or people claiming they can cure disease. But, you know, I do also reserve some of my time for criticizing proper scientists. And, you know, communication of risk is something that is very, very poor within the scientific community very often, especially in nutrition. You know, I was at a thing at the a couple of years ago, I think, the General Medical Council in London, and I was, you know, I was doing a little thing at the end and on a panel, and I criticized everyone had spoken before me, because every single person presented some sort of results, and I think almost all of them had used relative risk rather than absolute risk. And, you know, relative risk is a terrible way of communicating things to the public. It's useful for looking at assessing risk in academic study, but in terms of communicating to the public, using relative risk to describe how you know, dangerous something is, it is a terrible and often quite misleading way of communicating. But it is used in science communication all the time, because that makes the thing that you're talking about more interesting and more compelling, you know, and more worthy of note. So the scientists kind of have an interest in communicating that, because that gets their research publicity. The university publicity department have an interest in getting that publicity. The journalist has an interest in publishing that, because, you know, something causes a 40% increased risk of cancer is a big headline, but something causes a, you know, 0.01% increase in absolute risk of cancer is not a big headline. You know, so without figures for absolute risk, relative risk is, I believe, is meaningless. But it's used all the time in science communication, and it's well known that that's a terrible way of communicating risk. But it's still very, very common within the nutrition science community for various reasons, and lots of us sort of shout about it, but that doesn't seem to change, because people like big sort of scary numbers in their headlines in newspapers. You know, people blame the press, but I'm not sure that's always, I think there's a complicity right away along the chain of how those things are communicated. So yeah, I think people can understand risk, but I think that it is generally communicated in a really bad way to create this sort of sensationalism and create this sort of a lack of nuance. Once again, you know, there are sort of other various sort of complexities regarding how risk is communicated, and it is difficult for us to understand, you know, but it ends up with, you end up with some sort of ridiculous ridiculous situations happening. Because I think when risks become extremely salient, you know, when they become extremely visible in the public eye, they become things we are unnaturally afraid of, you know, perhaps to too great an extent. I'm not talking about, you know, the disease that we're going through now, but, you know, but I think generally the problem is more about how risk is communicated.
Sure, and there are just so many examples that we could use to put things into perspective to help everyone understand how important it is to properly quantify risk, and that relative risk is indeed a terrible way of communicating this to the general population. So for everyone listening, make sure to check for any news that you see on whatever topic it is in the future. It can be cancer risk, diabetes, or any cardiovascular disease. If the increased risk is quantified in relative risk, then it's going to appear much larger than it is, and in this case the absolute risk is a much better indicator. So Anthony, there is one other specific paragraph that I particularly like on your post going viral that could be associated with the true nature of people producing and releasing this false information in the world. And I think it's important to give to the listeners and provide them a profile of the people who produce this bad information that we have access to nowadays. And I'll quote your paragraph. "The world will bitterly remember those that try to exploit us in our darkest hour and confine to obscurity those that had nothing to offer." And this had me thinking about what type of people these self-proclaimed experts really are, with shortcuts to credentials they wish they had when using the words such as coach, expert, or specialist. Do you believe that these individuals are so eager to do this oversharing of dubious information to compensate for their low self-esteem, and how, the word might be too strong, but how useless they may feel or used to feel before their virtual popularity?
that's pretty strong. So I think there's this people have created an identity. Certainly a lot of the diet people, people selling fad diets, they've created quite a sort of a contrarian identity where they reject the conventional science, and that, you know, almost to an extent, a conspiracy theory mentality within diet, that sort of dietary guidelines are there to kill us, and that, you know, people have been lied to because of a massive conspiracy about, you know, combining the food industry and the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, all these sort of narratives about huge conspiracy do exist within diet communities. And they become very strong communities. And then there are people at the head of these communities who are these sort of new gurus. And that's been very much sort of built into people's identity really, really strongly. And it's a really curious phenomenon about diet, especially over the past few years, that we have this sort of very strong tribalism in diet. You know, we have this idea that you look at someone's social media profile, and one of the first thing they'll say about, you know, whether they're vegan or they're carnivore or they're keto or they're low carb, high fat, or they're real food, or they're, you know, whatever, that will be a very key part of their identity. And for me, that's really odd. For me, it's really odd to have what diet you're on as one of the most important things you want to tell the world about yourself, you know, is what you don't have for dinner. Because it's almost always about exclusion. It's almost always about denial. All these dietary ideologies about denial and sacrifice and not having certain things and not eating a certain, you know, not eating certain produce or certain, you know, not eating animals or not eating vegetables sometimes, or not eating anything processed. It's always about denial. It's always about restriction. Which is really troubling for me, but it's also quite, you know, it's quite telling how that's slightly sort of religious type language. And perhaps to some extent, this sort of dietary tribalism has replaced religion in many people's lives, as, you know, religion has declined. Maybe dietary ideologies have sort of overtaken them in many people. And it's because it's something you say to signal something about yourself to the world. It's something that I do. And, it, you know, it shows your privilege. And it shows you're able to do this sort of restriction, and it shows you have these sort of false perceptions of purity and denialism, which again are quite religious in nature. But what that does, I mean, the problem with that is that when it becomes so tied to people's identity, then it becomes a very important thing about them. And actually, when I come along, or many of the other people who come along and start to challenge the science on which they built this identity and say, nah, well, you haven't quite got that right, or you've misinterpreted that, or you've cherry-picked that bit of information, or this is different to how you think it is. When you start challenging that, you really start challenging something very fundamental about people. So it's no longer about just challenging the science. It's about challenging someone's identity, and they become incredibly resistant. And so you have these people fall into these very, very strict tribes. And I said they're about sort of contrarianism. They're about rejecting authority. They're about rejecting scientific consensus. So when something like this comes along right now, these people are in a difficult position. Either they say, I was wrong, we must completely accept what the authorities are saying, we must completely accept that these people know what they're talking about, these are people with expertise, or they have to double down and they have to say, no, hang on a minute, I've been built my identity around saying that, you know, conventional science doesn't understand, and, you know, actually this is the reality. So they have to double down. Otherwise, they show themselves up for being, you know, they completely shatter this identity they've created online, and this community they have around them will just sort of disown them and say, you know, you told us it was one way and now you're saying it's something else. So they have to double down. And a lot of them are doubling down onto this sort of pseudoscience of saying their diet will protect them from the virus, or, you know, and if everyone else eats this way, then this will solve this problem, and it's all to do, you know, because they've said, you know, like I said, food is medicine, and the most important thing about that health is the food you eat, and all this stuff is key to their identity. So if they hold their hands up and say I was wrong now, these people are going to be in a lot of trouble, and they're going to lose everything that they've spent so long creating. So a lot of them are just doubling down. You know, there's a very contrarian view about coronavirus, and a lot of, you know, not even that extreme diet communities, people saying, you know, that it's all about diet, and saying that certain diets will protect it, and it's saying that it's all a symptom of the way, you know, the food environment we have now, and even saying that, you know, the scientists have got the numbers wrong, and it's not, you know, the statistics are different to how you think they are, and saying that you can be protected if you're on keto diets, and all these ridiculous things, you know, that's all out there now, because these people have created identity about it, and they can't back down on that now. And, you know, I think for a large community of people that is going to be problematic. And obviously, you know, I have no particular issues with someone, you know, doing themselves harm because of a particular dietary ideology. But now we're in a situation where it doesn't just do them harm, it does communities harm. Because if some people aren't taking medical advice in a situation like this, then that endangers far more than just them. You know, and that sort of crosses a line as far as I'm concerned. And quite a serious and important line. You know, I don't mind when people are on a stupid diet and have a stupid dietary belief too much. I'll call them out. I don't mind that much. But when that starts endangering other people, then it becomes a completely different ballgame, and we need to be sort of come down far more hard on these people and expose them far more.
100%, Anthony. Well, there's just so much to take in from your answer right now that I don't even know where to start. But yeah, I mean, diet tribalism, I believe, is the main issue with all of this, and how people feel that they are part of some sort of cult and get defensive as if you were attacking part of their identity without even realizing it. Even the ketogenic diet advocates said on Twitter regarding the coronavirus pandemic that we should place our faith in a high-fat diet, since elevated blood cholesterol concentration was known to increase infection resistance, from what I remember. And wow. Now, my point is that the labels change, and we don't even realize how the keto advocates now were the paleo advocates from before. Some of them transitioned to the functional foodism, some of them to transition to keto diet, but all of them radical. That's the thing. And even the plant-based approach is all about, you know, eat like me and save the world, improve your health, or you're wrong and you're ruining the environment, which is, I believe, it has some additional things to consider, and it's not a topic for this podcast. So for my next question, I'll use a quote from Steven Pinker taken from one of your books, and it goes like this: most of what I read about food is patently illogical and seems to tap into a combination of status signaling and primitive intuitions about purity, contamination, and essentialism. Among other things, there's no nutritionally coherent category called processed. And adhering to the locavore food mice religion would mean that I would never eat an orange again. Now, Anthony, you're a chef, and you probably understand the meaning of eating whole foods and have a better relationship with food better than anyone. But for the majority of people, I fear this will only lead to the same labeling that it would be used to sell pure foods again. So my question here is regarding how obsessed we have become with labeling and reducing down effects of food to isolated ingredients, which ultimately will keep on damaging people's relationship with food, from my perspective. Would you agree that such reductionist approaches would similarly lead to the same rule-driven fad diets?
Yeah, no, it certainly does. I think you sort of have to, if you dip back into the, you know, the past of nutrition science, you know, obviously the important things in nutrition science has done over time, it has been quite reductionist, you know, discovering that certain vitamin deficiencies amino acid deficiencies cause certain health effects. That was an important step. Those are important steps in nutrition and improving the diets of the world. But you know, kind of once you have an adequate diet, once you have all the micronutrients you need, and the small number of other bits and pieces you need, the rest of it, I think is actually reasonably irrelevant. We are very adaptable species. You know, that's the one of the most important things about humans in terms of what we can and can eat. We are extremely adaptable, and we tend to just adapt. You know, once you've got all the certain basic requirements, we can pretty much eat whatever. In my opinion, and this sort of idea of reductionism and taking things down and thinking that like you said earlier, this idea that food is medicine is incredibly popular, and people will sort of say it as a sage bit of wisdom. But personally, I think it does a disservice to both food and to medicine, because food is far more than just medicine. It's far more than something you should take medically. It's something that's important socially. It's something that's important for bringing us together. It's something that's an important source of pleasure. And if you kind of reduce it down to a specific set of chemicals that you're going to put in your body, I think that's a terrible thing, terrible way to relationship to have with food. But I also think it can lead you to sort of really problematic behaviors and problematic diets. My personal belief, and I might be wrong, but my personal dietary belief is really that we should try and eat as varied and interesting a diet as possible. And all the dietary fads, they're all based on restriction in some way. They're all usually based on cutting out an entire food group, or cutting out an entire thing, or idolizing a certain ingredient. Idolizing, like you said, the idolization of protein, I think, is really problematic. See all these products with sort of extra protein and protein boosted chocolate bars and protein boosted everything, and we have this obsession with a certain ingredient. I think that's really problematic personally. I just don't understand the need for it at all, and that sort of reductionism is always problematic. That idea that if I eat A, B will happen, is just the wrong way to think about food. I think you should certainly have to get a certain amount of micro and macronutrients. That's really important, and far more of us are deficient in those than they should be. In the society we live in, so it's an unspoken problem, lack of different micronutrients. But once you have all those, then I think that people should just relax a bit more. And I think they'd be much happier with their diet if they just relaxed a bit more. And that's something I've always felt. I feel this obsession with what we should and shouldn't be eating and what food is good and bad is the most problematic thing about people's diets almost entirely. I think that's what causes 90% of our problematic relationships with food. It's just people obsessing about what's good and bad and what they should and shouldn't be eating, rather than just relaxing and trying to enjoy eating a varied and interesting diet.
Yes, but why do you think this message is just so difficult to pass? I mean, from the moment you use the word moderation, people automatically disconnect and you lose them. And I understand that moderation doesn't sell books, as you said. People want to understand the world and have a simplified solution for their problem. And this message is what we've been trying to pass on for a long time, we nutritionists. So how can we improve the way of communicating this message without using the word moderation? Do you know what I mean, Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, I always worry about even using that word moderation. I think it's more about variety. I think it's more about encouraging variety and encouraging people, because I think if you eat a diet with loads of different fruits and vegetables and beans and pulses and legumes and all these things and occasional bits of oily fish and stuff, if you eat loads and loads of different stuff, you'll generally land on a fairly healthy diet. If you only eat burger and chips, you won't eat a healthy diet. Also, if you only eat cucumber and kale, you won't eat a healthy diet. So I think it's a case of, you know, it's like all these things. You'll only get so far telling people off. You only get so far telling people they're doing stuff wrong and telling people what they shouldn't eat and telling people what they should avoid. It's a really terrible way to motivate people to a positive behavior change. It's to make them feel guilty about it. You know, it'll short term, it'll work, but long term, it won't. If you tell people that something is bad and something is not a good thing and you should avoid it and it's terrible and it's, you know, poisonous or whatever, then that creates, you know, it does create a sort of salience to those sort of things. So telling someone never eat chocolate, chocolate's terrible, it's full of calories, it's really calorie dense, it's really hyper palatable, which it is, you know, but if you tell people that's a terrible thing, that will create a salience for it in their mind, and they will just think about chocolate all the time, and they will find that thing hard to resist when they get there. You know, what we really need to do, and it's a very difficult thing to do, is kind of it's a fundamental restructuring of the food system, so it's not an easy thing, but it's making sure that there's a variety of interesting stuff available to people, and creating a world where the diet that you want people to eat is also the diet that they want to eat. That's the thing that's pleasurable and desirable. Because if you're just saying eat this thing as a penance, you know, drink this sort of green juice, or eat, we've been telling people to eat more fruits and vegetables for as long as I've been alive, I think. Probably not quite that long, actually. But, you know, we've generally been telling people to eat more fruits and vegetables, eat 5 portions a day or 7 portions a day or whatever. And they don't do it. You know, because it feels we've kind of spent so long telling people that they're not doing enough. It feels like a penance. It feels like something that's difficult, rather than encouraging that as a thing that's pleasurable and a thing that's enjoyable and a thing that's discovering new flavors and eating things that are really, really delicious. We've framed it as being something that is, you know, a thing that people a kind of doing to make themselves feel good. We're framing food as being a medicine, something you have to, you know, a pill that you have to take, which is unpleasant, whereas we should be framing it as a pleasure, and we should be creating a world and a society where the things that, you know, the better diets that people are going to find more healthful are actually the ones that are pleasurable and desirable and the people aspire to. And I think that's what we miss out. We make it a penance. We make it feel like a bad thing that you have to do, and it's worthy, and that's what good people do. But actually the real pleasure is in other stuff. Whereas actually, you know, healthy foods, I mean, any food in a certain moderation is healthy, but a healthy dietary pattern can be really, really enjoyable and really, really exciting. And we don't frame it as that. We frame it as being, you know, the good thing to do, and that makes it just instantly makes it sort of boring and something I want to resist for most people. And I think the biggest problem of getting people to eat healthily is our obsession with healthy eating. I think if we didn't have that obsession with healthy eating, with all the food we have available today and all the produce we have available, which is sort of incredible and wonderful and a miracle of modern food systems. You know, our modern food system is a complete miracle. You can go into any supermarket in this country, and you have such an incredible variety of different fresh produce and loads of really healthy things that you can eat. And it's just getting people into really aspiring to eating a wide variety of different things and taking pleasure in the things that we want them to eat, rather than getting obsessed about what is good and what is bad and moralizing about food. We should just be encouraging people to eat all different foods. You know, as we've said a couple of times, we obsess that food is medicine, you know, and medicine is unpleasant and it doesn't taste good, and you have to swallow it. But what we should be doing is appreciating food as this sort of wonderful, pleasurable thing. And I think if we did that and we created a world where the things that people aspired to were the things that we wanted them to eat, then we would have a chance of encouraging positive behavior change.
Yeah, and medicine is artificial and food is natural, right?
Yeah, a lot of it. I think it's really problematic to frame food as medicine, because I just think it, especially in times like this, that's not you don't people don't want to take the medicine. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of something you have to do, I don't believe that the food just doesn't work in that way. It's something you would just be so much better off if we just framed food as being the pleasurable thing that we enjoy, and a varied interesting diet as being a pleasurable thing that you enjoy, because medicine is not something you enjoy, is it?
Not at all, Anthony. So before we start wrapping things up here, do you see any relationship between the current lack of general food education in Western countries? I'm referring to the poor relationship we have with food, along with the scarce cooking skills, knowledge of gastronomy, and even basic concepts of agriculture and crops. I mean, we are getting into a generation that doesn't know where vegetables or other fresh produce comes from. And from my perception, I feel that these are the countries and societies that repeatedly and more easily fall into these trends. Do you think that improvements in these isolated fields would contribute in any way for us to become more self-aware and help us filter information in the future? Or do you think there are any other major factors at play here?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I think it's very easy trap to fall into, to assume that people just need more knowledge. And I don't think that's always the case, actually. I don't think most people need an intricate knowledge of the food system. It would be nice if people were a bit more connected to where their food comes from, and understood it a bit more, and understood how modern agriculture works, and because I think we have a tendency to romanticize it to an extent, and that can be quite problematic. But I don't think we need to be careful about saying people just need more information and then they'll behave better, because I don't think that's always the case, actually. I used to very much advocate that, but more and more I think now, we have so much information in our modern lives that we have to process. You can't be an expert on everything. There's plenty of things that I do and I don't know exactly how they work. I don't necessarily need to know exactly how the food system works. I don't need to know, even don't need to be an extraordinary, I don't think everyone needs to be an extraordinary cook. I just think it's what we were saying earlier. It's about having some basic skills to critically assess information and think more deeply about it, and also have an awareness of our own cognitive failings, make people understand more, because all the stuff that I've described, like us wanting simplicity over complexity and us idolizing the past and us wanting to exist in tribes and the problems that can lead to, all those things, that's not, I'm not talking about other people, I'm talking about all of us do that to some extent in some way. We all fall into certain tribes, we all like to look for simple solutions to complex problems we don't understand, because we perhaps know or are more interested in the field of nutrition, we don't fall into those traps so often in that field, but I'm sure we would in other fields, like in politics or technology or all these things. I think it's giving people that ability to assess complex information better, and it's also perhaps really, really important, actually, is somehow getting back, reiterating the importance of expertise, because I think we've lost that very much, and that's really problematic. And maybe, if there is some sort of silver lining to the crisis we're going through now, maybe we will start to turn more towards, we will realize the value of expertise, because it will be the experts who guide us through this crisis. We need to have confidence in them, and hopefully, as things progress, that will sort of change, because I think that's an incredibly dangerous sort of situation where everyone's suddenly their expert and the people with genuine expertise are shouted down by people who have sometimes louder voices and bigger followings. That would be the thing that I really want to change, if anything, is getting people back to understanding what real expertise looks like, which is often someone who's a little bit willing to accept uncertainty and isn't quite isn't always able to give you a simple answer to a complex problem, but and also just helping people interpret information better and having a better sort of grounding within society generally of how to sort of interpret and process information and actually understand what science really is rather than the misconceptions we have about what sort of science and evidence looks like.
You've almost answered my final question there, Anthony, but I'll do it anyway and frame it differently. So we are reaching the end of the episode now. So how can we help people filter information regarding this issue of the coronavirus? We had inaccurate information circulating regarding nutrition. We have, you know, databases such as PubMed, which are available for people to check it. But in this particular case, not everyone is, I think, capacitated to deal with this information and they tend to misinterpret it. So taking the current pandemic context and all that has been happening in nutrition and everything that we've been talking about during this podcast, how can we boost our filter of information and go back to trusting expertise again?
It is very difficult. I think you have to understand, we have National Health Service in this country. I always think if someone's giving out information which is at odds with the information that's been given out by our National Health Service, or is at odds with the information that's been given out by our National Dietary Guidelines Committee, then you have to question why. And I think you have to understand, you have to help people understand perhaps how complex decisions are made on setting dietary guidelines. Because I think people perhaps assume that people sit around in a room and go, what should we tell people not to eat? Rather than understanding these are committees of the best people in the country who sit for months and have, look through hundreds of papers and look at all the weight of all the evidence that's out there, rather than just sort of, typing in a couple of search terms into PubMed and pulling up the first paper they see. And these are people who systematically review enormous amounts of information. May occasionally, get stuff slightly wrong over a period of time, but constantly reassess it and constantly relook. Willing to relook if different evidence appears. And I think getting people to understand the complexity of decision making that goes into health guidelines, that goes into sort of clinical guidelines, that goes into any sort of higher level health advice or nutrition advice, I think that would be a really good thing to do, because I think people don't really understand that, how those decisions have got to, and that's why they're sort of inclined to believe armchair experts who sit there and Google a couple of papers and go look what I've discovered, as if these sort of committees of professors and people with sort of a huge academic and clinical experience might have missed this thing that some engineer sat at home with a sort of 5-minute interest in nutrition has suddenly discovered. So I just think we need to kind of make people, I think what I said before, understand what expertise looks like. I think we kind of in a society where it's about sort of media presentation very often, about how people come across on social media and about what they look like and look like, eat like me, look like me sort of things. We need to get people back to really believing in expertise and break down some of this sort of I think we are adjusting to a social media age. We're adjusting to a different way of assimilating information in society. And I think the things we're seeing through this sort of tribalism that's being created and these false beliefs, I think it's a blip. I really do hope it is. I really hope we'll get to a better place with it as kind of society adjusts, because it has changed dramatically. And for me, the real key to that I think it's really about how we teach science and how we educate people, especially at school level, before, not necessarily at university level, but at school level, where we're teaching people the first sort of inkling of science that we give them should not be, here's a list of facts, here's a list of stuff. It should be, here's how we get to the truth. Here's what science is. Here's this incredible process which has created these incredible advances in society. This is how it works, and this is the uncertainty at its heart, and find a way of teaching that to people as they first start to encounter science. And that, I hopefully, would sort of underlie their sort of interaction with it going forward. Yeah, even if they don't go on to study it in the future, they will sort of have a better understanding of what truth looks like and what science is for. Because I think it very much isn't what a lot of people think it is.
Let's hope this message spreads like a virus and we've contributed in some way to enlighten listeners a bit more about this important tool, which is our capacity to deal with information that is becoming more and more important, particularly in the situation we're going through right now. Anthony, we've briefly mentioned your books, but could you tell us a bit more about them in case people are interested in checking them out or acquiring them? And also, where can people follow you and keep up with your angriness?
Go on my website, which is the Angry Chef blog. Yeah, the first book, The Bad Science of Truth About Healthy Eating, is available. I think it's available in most European languages. My second book, called The Truth About Fat. I have a third book coming out soon. But buy them from wherever you buy books. They're available in all the usual places. Probably online these days, e-readers and audiobooks. And sort of follow me on Twitter, where I do most of my shouting at people, and read the blog, because I'm posting quite a bit at the moment.
I can confirm that Anthony is quite active on Twitter as the Hangry Chef, and it's a really good Twitter profile to follow if you like this kind of topics. Even Professor Stuart Phillips, who has been here on the podcast before, gave great compliments to the post on the Hangry Chef blog going viral that we've been talking about here on the podcast, and that I really recommend you to read. And we could almost say that it motivated this episode as well. So, Anthony, thank you so much for being on Fuel the Pedal.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. It's good to be on.
And it's finally done. Thank you for listening until the very end of the episode. I know this topic might appear to have nothing to do with cycling or sports nutrition in general, but I honestly believe that these tools to better fill information go beyond the coronavirus pandemic and are useful for a lot of contacts while working with athletes who sometimes are the ones falling into these traps, and it's our job as nutritionists to be somehow prepared to help them distinguish between what is true expertise and what is not. Thanks again for tuning in, and I wish you all the best in these difficult times. Stay safe, people. Talk to you soon.